and as my wife puts it, we had to pay off the mortgage on the baby.
She seems to have quite a remarkable background of varied interests of her own. Was that one of the things that drew the two of you together?
Oh yes. I mean, besides being beautiful and charming and so forth, she had and has brains. We can talk about a lot of things. We're not bored in each other's company, and she's published some things of her own, and some in direct collaboration with me, and she always writes herd. She's become what she calls my resident nitpicker. In fact, just before I came here, she went over the first draft of the book I'm currently working on, and checking all sorts of facts that I hadn't taken time myself, considering the logic of this and that. This passage, you're not making yourself quite clear here. And, hey, look, you've got the French grammar all wrong here. And
most people have to pay a lot of money to have a researcher do that of thing.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, she's so good at it that our son-in-law, Greg Baer, is a writer himself, a very good and very successful one. But when he found out what was going on, he asked if he could have the same service. Greg is probably the only man alive who actively invites his mother-in-law's criticism.
Is there a working title for the new book?
We went around and around with it between the editor and editorial staff and myself. Finally settled on The Stars Are Also Fire. But don't hold your breath. It isn't due out till next summer.
A little bit ago, you mentioned Gardner Dixon. The two of you knew each other as young folks in this area?
Yes. We met through the Minneapolis Fantasy Society, both being members.
And you began working together, not just drinking buddies, but working together when?
Well, we were both writing, mostly writing independently of each other, but from time to time, just sitting and talking, in the course of conversation, we'd get to batting around a story idea, and next thing you knew, that was a story just needing to be written.
Is it a question of each of you bringing something different to the task, or do you confirm each other's talents?
Well, I've known a number of collaborations. I've collaborated with other people, too, and I've known other teams. And collaborations are like marriages. No two are alike. In the case of Gordy and myself, we'd kick the idea around till we knew pretty much what was going to do. Then he, having the more inventive sense of humor, would quickly do a first draft, and I, being perhaps a little more systematic in my thinking, would do a second draft, tying up the loose ends and throwing in any other bits of business that occurred to me, and generally that was it.
To date, how many stories and books, a rough estimate, and what are some of the titles that you would encourage people first coming to your works to start reading?
Well, I am often asked that, and my reply always has to be, what sort of thing do you like to read? Because there is a pretty fair range. I mean, if, for example, you like fantasy fiction, I've done some out-and-out fantasy novels.
I'm referring to the collaborations.
Collaborations with Gordon Dixon.
Right. And what are some of the things that a prospective reader...
Yeah. I don't know as how anything is currently in print. Our collaborations, just about all, with this one single exception, they're all same series of stories, the Hoka stories about this race of little beings on another planet. They look rather like large teddy bears. who enthusiastically set out to emulate this or that aspect of human culture, which, however, they only know through books or shows or something. So,
the satyr's dream.
Yeah, right. So the first collection of these was called Earthman's Burden. And then there's a second collection called Hoka. And we also did a juvenile novel called Star Prince Charlie with the Hoka character.
And the name comes from Hoka?
H-O-K-A. We simply made it up. I don't remember if we ever had any specific reason for settling on that.
Now, to do a series of stories like this with an adult audience in mind strikes me as, again, being somewhat new for the field, was it not? You would have expected to have seen these in juvenile series, but targeted for adult readers?
No, there'd been humorous stories before in the field, in fact, even series of them. For example, Henry Kuttner did a whole series of
the Hog Bands.
Which,
the Hog Band family?
That, or I was thinking more of his Gallagher stories under the Lewis Paget pseudonym, the wonderful stories about this scientific genius who, however, only functioned, was an alcoholic and only functioned when he was drunk. He'd wake up from a toot and found he had invented something, but he couldn't remember what it was for.
But especially stories like yours that involve the little fuzzy animals, mm-hmm. the kind of thing that you might have expected to have seen only in juveniles. I mean, that was unique.
Yeah, well, we didn't think of it in those terms. We wrote it for anyone of any age who cared to read.
Sure.
The two, he's here, correct, this weekend?
Yes.
When the two of you get together again, is it usually after a long separation? I mean, you don't live in the same places?
Oh, no. I live out in California these days.
And
Cordy's still here in Minnesota.
Oh, he's still here. And when you see each other, is the last thing on your minds to talk about a book? Is it all just other stuff?
Well, sometimes just swapping gossip and what have you. You know, what are you working on currently? Oh, this and that. You know, and then we get on to something else.
Now, I know I've already gone way over time, but I haven't even gotten to Boat. Could we take Boat of a Million Years? I just finished, and it really kind of stretches your mind to encompass this thing as a reader. As a writer, I can scarcely imagine the imaginative power that takes to encompass such a book. Or does it just grow over a whole career? It seems to me maybe this book is a kind of synthesis of so many things that you've been working on for such a long time.
Well, to some extent, yes. Especially anything book length that I do, the writing itself is really only the tail end of the process. I'll be a long time thinking about it, working up background, if necessary, calculating how something ought to go. I mean, for example, for those, the Alpha Centauri system in that novel, I was consulting people about the orbital stability, orbital mechanics, and so on, doing calculations of my own, just how fast would that planetary collision take place, and what would it look like? That, you know, imagine figuring out, well, how fast is this thing going to be coming at you anyway, and therefore how fast will it seem to grow in your eyes? That sort of thing. Trying to get that right, or even as simple a thing which all too many writers never think about: getting the phase of the moon right on a particular day. I hate to think how many stories I've read where with a new moon rising at sunset or a crescent moon, that sort of thing. And also thinking about Well, you know, there are a great many things happening in the world. John Campbell used to say, nothing happens one at a time. And so the future is not going to be determined by any one trend, but by an awful lot of them, including many that are unforeseeable, that haven't even begun yet. You can only guess that.
Also, I rather fancied that reading that little poem that you have at the very beginning mm-hmm. might have been the sort of thing you would have read and suddenly, instantly, everything focuses in your brain. Or do you find a poem like that later? Oh, yes, The Boat of a Million Years. You know, what a wonderful concept.
Yeah.
Did that confirm a process already starting, or did you read some lines like that and suddenly it triggered things?
Oh,
I'm trying to remember the poem.
Wait. The Boat of a Million. I'm sorry. I was actually talking about the new one,
Harvest of Stars.
Yeah. But Boat of a Million Years cut. Yeah, that's a somewhat different proposition because there's only one section of it that's up in the future.
Well,
yeah, but
long.
And there aren't any colliding planets.
I was wondering about Alpha Centauri, but I remember when they go into the final, or the contact. Which is never really a contact at all. You really play with that notion.
Yeah.
But before we get to that poem that you talk about.
Oh, that. That's actually an it isn't so much a poem. It's a line, you know, part of a long invocation or prayer from the so-called Book of the Dead of ancient Egypt. My wife researched it for me, and in fact, did the hieroglyphs.
Yeah.
I think. No, I didn't. That in itself didn't suggest a book. It just seemed like a reasonable epigraph.
Readers like me, I don't know how many people you've talked to about that book. One of the surprises for me was how long it took, quote, to get off the planet, to use the term we referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. You are very careful in laying the groundwork on all these characters.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about essentially about those characters, the immortals. And as a matter of fact, the future section set in the future was, I originally wrote it, was much shorter. All I wanted to do was really point up the irony of the probable fact that once society had evolved to the point where these people dared reveal themselves, it would be so alien that they'd find it intolerable. And I was going to leave it at that, but the editor asked for more material. Some readers have said they wished he hadn't, and others have said they liked that part best. So,
but you're square up against a dilemma that every science fiction writer has, which is how do I talk about interstellar space when nobody lives long enough to make a journey? You know, Methuselah's Children has its way of dealing with it. Immortals is another way. Is that almost an insoluble problem?
No, there are various things you can do. The most usual thing, of course, is just to postulate some way of getting around the light speed limit. You know, you talk about hyperspace or warp speed or something. You know, arm waving is what it amounts to.
It can become jargon if you're not careful. Yeah, and the reader then says,
Yeah. Well, I mean, it can be honestly done, and there are some stories that simply require it.
Doc Smith usually had his own ways around that.
Yeah, you have to. If you're going to tell a certain story at all, you have to get your characters onto the scene in reasonable time. And at a reasonable energy cost. Well, you know, conceivably, there will be some such discoveries in physics that will make that possible. But I find, and I've assumed it myself often enough, but I find myself increasingly interested in, you know, accepting the Einsteinian speed limitation and seeing what you can do within that. And there are different possibilities there. One, of course, would be some form of suspended animation. There'd be limits set on that, but still you could perhaps lie there like a block of ice for 100 years or so at least, maybe several hundred years, and then be revived at the other end. Another one, of course, if you can find a way to do it, find a way to get the energy, is simply to go very fast.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a whole novel about that, Tau Zero.
What was that again?
Tau Zero was the title of it a number of years ago. Well, that's a very hard science novel. It assumes relativity. It was based on a perfectly legitimate suggestion by a space scientist by the name of Bassard. Well, to back up a little, the idea of taking any kind of ordinary rocket and pushing it up to close to the speed of light is absurd. You know, like forget it. It can't happen. But Bassard pointed out, though, that interstellar space is not really a vacuum. There's matter floating around in there, very thin, but hydrogen gas mostly, about one atom per cubic centimeter in our neighborhood. And so if you could get up to a certain reasonable speed and start scooping up enough of that hydrogen and using fusion, a ramjet effect, you could live off the country, so to speak.
Wow.
And so I got to thinking, well, gee, in that case, theoretically, you know, just short of the only limit on speed, you know, is light itself. And so I had such a spaceship with a crew of people going to another star. But it met with an accident along the way, such that it could not decelerate. It had to keep accelerating, because if it simply stopped and floated, radiation from all this matter, it was, you know, simply went on trajectory. The radiation from all this matter it was running into would fry everybody in very short order. So they just had to keep going, pushing closer and closer to the speed of light, and therefore, by the laws of relativity, their rate of time, so to speak, stretched out, you know, until eventually millions of years might pass by outside while somebody inside the ship drew a breath. And so in the end, they outlived the universe and so on.
Wow.
Yes, it got very cosmic.
Wow.
Yeah, the book has actually been used in some physics classes to help teach relativity.
Now, on the psychological dimension, Boat of a Million Years, of course, deals with characters who are living forever, and how does that affect them emotionally and psychologically? If I recall, you only have one of them commit suicide. I think one of them feels the weight of what's to come.
The rest of them remain pretty healthy.
Yeah, well, of course, the idea was that born immortals would be very rare to start with, and most of them wouldn't survive. Some accident would take them off fairly early on. I mean, remember, the world everywhere used to be a pretty dangerous place, and most parts of it still are. So the issue would never arise, and others would live so long that neighbors would start getting too suspicious of them, you know, or is this a witch or something, and put them to death, that sort of thing. So, you know, I was assuming that those who could actually make a go of it for a long time would have to have a combination of determination, cleverness, and sheer luck. And that, among other things, of course, simplify matters by keeping the cast of characters a reasonable size.
Right.
It's gone in and out of different editions now, and it seems to be on its way to being regarded as one of your signature books, one of your best books. What do you feel about that evaluation, or is there another title somewhere mm-hmm. we haven't even mentioned yet that in your own mind far better aspires to that title?
No, I wouldn't say that because, well, of course, some are better than others, but Antony Boucher used to say that the person least qualified to judge a book is the author. I'd say there's, perhaps half a dozen of mine that are better than any of the others, but I wouldn't care to choose between them. For one thing, they're very different from each other.
You seem to be writing more rather than less. I mean, if you look at the book list in the program there, there's a gradually accelerating listing of books. Are you working harder, more?
No, that's very deceptive. Take another look, a closer look at that bibliography. You'll find and look at copyright dates or original publication uh-huh. dates, and a lot of stuff, old stuff, is getting reprinted. But you know, I've been at it for well over 40 years, and there's quite a backlog. So, no, actually, my rate of production is way down.
Have you ever been a mentor, as it were, for any younger writers coming up now? Or at least, are there any younger writers that you're watching with special interest?
No, not really. I've never tried to teach her anything. If somebody asked for some advice, well, as I said before, there's really very little I can say, because writing such a very personal matter, at most I can just make a suggestion. You know, well, maybe this scene would work a little better if you did it such and such a way. But really, that's a function of the editor, I would say. And as for new up-and-coming writers, well, there are some very good ones, but I hesitate to name any for fear of leaving off some who ought to be named. Frankly, I don't read an awful lot of fiction anymore anyway.
Mm-hmm. Let me begin to close this out by asking you if over the years you have seen what you think are major changes in the science fiction writing field, or on balance, has it remained a fairly consistent body of work by you or others? Any big changes
in the concerns, whatever?
Well, yes, various ways. I would talk about the Campbell Golden Age, and I think it was a golden age, not just because that was when I started reading, although obviously that's part of it, but there was this sense of green pastures. All sorts of themes were being explored. And, of course, you can only something is only new, really new, once. So that particular sense will never come again. But, of course, there's all sorts of variations and possibilities to explore, and every once in a while something really new will come along.
Or if not new, do you see at least more of a preoccupation with things like ecology and stuff like that? I'm thinking of Stanley Robinson.
Yeah. You know. Well, I would say probably the main difference in science fiction now as opposed to, say, back then, 30 or more years ago, it's just the sheer size of the field these days. Nobody can keep up. Back in those days, you could read everything that was published under the name of science fiction, and that'd probably just be a rather small part of your total reading. These days, if you spend all your waking hours reading science fiction, you still couldn't keep up. So, of course, this means that on the one hand, an awful lot of garbage c- c- comes out. But on the other hand, just on the law of averages, there's going to be a lot of good stuff too. And the problem is to separate the wheat from the chaff. And, well, there's more, probably more emphasis on, in some way or other, trying to deal with current problems, projecting them into the immediate future and so on, whole cyberpunk movement, et cetera, et cetera. Generally rather depressing near futures.
But
that again is by no means the whole of the field or even the majority of it. You've got all sorts of things going simultaneously. So there's certainly more opportunity for a writer now than there ever was before.
Beyond the obvious fact that you have immortals in boat, can the book also be seen, though generally, as a metaphor for an affirmation that life will go on, that there is an immortality granted all of us in some way, if it's not a strictly religious mm-hmm. statement, is at least maybe more of a philosophical one?
I suppose so. I mean, I would like to believe that, and as a matter of fact, biologically speaking, you know, it's overwhelmingly likely that life on Earth will go on till the sun gets too hot, perhaps for another billion years. But whether the human race will or not, that's something else again. But of course, that's biologically trivial. Yeah.
But as a metaphor for maybe that there's a human soul mm-hmm. which will go on, do you ever permit yourself such speculations in your fiction that might approach the more religious in content?
Oh, somewhat, yes. You know, when one can speculate, one can speculate about these things, I like to think. I hope it's true that, though I won't, we're none of us gonna live to see it in the nature of the case. But I mean, I hope it's true that humanity will go on and actually start acquiring a little wisdom. And the heritage will survive and will continue to grow.
Okay. Is Sir Dominic Flandry in retirement? I've never read the Flandry of Terra.
Oh,
what am I missing? What?
He was quite a man.
Who was Flandry? What was that?
Oh, that was.
Catching up to do.
Oh, that was a series of more or less swashbuckling adventure stories I did with a galactic, well, interstellar background. I don't believe in galactic empires. The galaxy's simply too big.
But
you know, our neighborhood. And to some extent, many just stories for entertainment. But there was this background of decadence. To some extent, it was a paradigm for the real world historical cases. Flandry is in the Naval Intelligence Service of the Terran Empire. He knows it's doomed by its own follies. The best he can hope to do is help, you know, do whatever little bit he's able to keep things going as long as possible.
But it swashes and buckles, does it?
Oh, yeah,
space
yeah.
opera with a bit of a social conscience?
Something like that, yes.
I miss that kind of stuff in what a lot of new books I see. Mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of humor. I don't see a lot of adventure.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I try to supply such elements.